As they say, the reason we play the games is to find out who wins. Because you never
No, that's not true anymore, Bob. We play the games to reinforce the analytics.
Well,
that's what we do.
The analytics under any circumstance would not have favored the Atlanta Braves in the postseason. Probably wouldn't have supported them in the last 30 games of the regular season. But they managed to squeak in with the worst record among teams that qualified for the postseason and are now World Series champions. And we do know that Alex Anthopoulos, the general manager in Atlanta, made significant changes. His whole outfield at or before the trade deadline.
Four guys.
But should that have been enough? I don't know. Under normal circumstances, probably not. Although we know that from 2015, Alex Anthopoulos did a similar thing with more impactful players and managed to get into the playoffs when his team was under 500 at that time too. So he's done this twice. Doesn't mean it works every time. And I guess you got to play the games, as they say.
Well, the interesting thing is, and it was, if you recall, the day before the deadline in 2015, they were one game. The Jays were under 500. Atlanta did not get to the 500 mark this season until August the 6th. And won 88 games, three less than the Jays and the Mariners, to advance to the postseason and then play pretty well. Obviously, the other interesting thing, Bob, and this is has been a topic du jour for a lot of our baseball discussion, is the Braves win the World Series going 1-1 with bullpen starts. And so the question becomes, does that reinforce the whole concept of bullpen starts, or does that contradict? And the answer is, what they were able to do is tread water through those two starts while they were able to get a guy like Max Fried back on the mound for game six.
Well, look, you know, I've said this a million times. I'm not much for analytics. I believe in the eye test. I believe in having confidence in the decisions that you make. And I would rather, I still rather have three really good starting pitchers and two decent starting pitchers. That's the formation by which you start a baseball team, in my opinion. And yet there are a significant number, almost all major league teams now have stopped looking at it that way. And yet at the end of the day, there will be starting pitchers that are free agents this year that will get 20, 25, maybe $30 million a year and won't contribute nearly what they would have contributed 10 years ago.
Or may not finish the season.
There's an inconsistency to the philosophy, in my opinion. If you're going to do bullpen guys, if you're going to play this way, then you better prioritize your bullpen.
Yeah.
And that's the dilemma, because bullpen guys still to this day traditionally are failed starters. Right. And are you prepared to give a failed starter $15 million a year, $20 million a year? One of the prime examples from relatively recent history, you remember Papelbon?
Sure.
Got, I think, a $10 million contract when that was an awful lot of money. In Washington, right? And he had proven over an extended period of time that he was really good out of the bullpen, got the money, and never was able to live up to that financial commitment. And there's, you know, the Toronto Blue Jays have had plenty of stories of guys that they relied on in the bullpen and they didn't materialize. Wow. So, and it's principally because at some point in your life, you don't say, I want to grow up. What do you want to be? I want to be a relief pitcher. You want to be a starter.
Sure.
And at some point you fail at that or aren't deemed as good as somebody else. And so you wind up going to the bullpen. And your skills and talents, even at that level, rarely are sustainable. Rarely. So therein lies the conundrum for the future of baseball.
Yeah. And how about our friend Alex Anthopoulos puts this team together, makes the big changes at the deadline, and gets to watch it at home like we did.
Well, had to watch it at home, didn't get to watch it at home.
Well, he got to watch it.
Well, yes, I assume so. He has COVID, of course, and I assume won't be able to participate in the parade either.
I don't know. Well, unless they delay the parade. So we'll have to figure that one out. So.
Well, I can't imagine they'll delay the parade just for the general manager. Although
they should. They should.
Again, well, he did the job that he's expected to do, and it wound up working.
Some good Canadian content on that team, too, when you think of Freddie Freeman being Canadian. And then Mike Sorotka, who's from Calgary, who obviously is injured, but it was still a big part of the Braves for this season. So,
Hockey Talk today. The president of hockey ops for the Pittsburgh Penguins, Brian Burke, will join us. We'll get to that after these messages. Bob McCowan, it's John Shannon on the podcast/radio show on Sirius XM, channel 167. And there's one of our faves, the president of hockey ops for the Pittsburgh Penguins. Brian Burke is with us. Burkey, you look beautiful. How are you?
I know better than that, but good to see you both.
Yeah, listen, I'm not used to seeing the actual Brian Burke. I'm so used to seeing that damn cartoon, you know.
No, people like that. Hey, Burkey, I apologize. I don't have a poppy on. I did not bring one, and it's at my office downtown. So otherwise, I'd have a poppy on.
Your hockey team got off to a surprisingly quick start, considering the injuries, the key injuries that you had, and then pummeled the Toronto Maple Leafs in that process 7-1, and since then have been outscored 13-3 and with three consecutive losses. Is it as simple as being able to analyze the difference between the first three games effectively and the last three games, Berkey?
Well, I think our feeling is that we played very well in those games. The score didn't always match the product in the game. The shots were in the first two games, the shots were even or we outshot them. We just didn't have enough firepower, I think, given the injuries that we had. We played well, generated lots of chances, just didn't have the manpower to finish the job. So we started really banged up. We've been hit by COVID. It's been like blow after blow to our team and all key guys, but we're starting to get back and get healthy, and now we'll see where COVID goes.
Actually, Brian, that's a really good point, because you're not the only team that has been affected by the virus. Do you get a sense that we're getting closer to the end of it when it comes to how we manage it with professional sports teams?
Well, I'm not sure. All of these guys that have been infected are breakthrough cases. They're guys that were double vaccinated and still, contracted the virus. So now we've had, no touch wood, we've had less severe symptoms. So clearly the vaccination program is working, but it still means we've tested positive and we've had some symptomatic players. Zach Aston-Reese had symptoms. Chris Letang had symptoms. So we're not out of the woods for sure. I think we're doing a better job. And certainly the vaccination program has proven that players that do contract the virus do not generally contract severe symptoms, which is a blessing, but it means we still have to deal with it.
Is there anything about the NHL system of dealing with the virus that you don't like? Are there changes to it that you would make?
Well, I'd leave that, this is a lawyer's answer. I'd leave it to the experts. Certainly, we feel our team has been diligent and vigilant in terms of mask wearing and testing, and we think we're doing everything right. It's just, this is a very contagious variant, and breakthrough cases are becoming more common. Again, albeit without serious symptoms, which is a blessing, but no, we're not out of the woods for sure. We think we've done a good job of containing the virus and containing the amount of transmission, but clearly we're not doing a good enough job.
We don't, there's no way to really know what impact wearing masks has on the spread of this. But do you have a policy within the organization for mask wearing? Because most of America has abandoned masks.
Yeah, no, we haven't changed our view on it. The players should wear masks. When we come in to get tested, we're all masked. When we go into the dressing room area, we're all masked. And then we're allowed to take our masks off and conduct normal team activities. But within that, yeah, we still are governed by the mask mandate. As far as, like, I was watching our players get tested today coming in. They're all masked, including me. We're all masked when we leave our cars. We're all masked to go in to get tested. So certainly our lifestyle is still based largely on masks. We wear masks wherever we go.
And are you tested every day, Brian?
We were tested every day after an outbreak. I think the league mandate is every third day. And so I think we've been going every third day, but then when we have an outbreak, we test more frequently. So I couldn't tell you with truthfulness or honesty what the program is today. I believe it's every day because now we're in the middle of an outbreak. So yeah, we've been tested a lot.
So societally, when you walk around Pittsburgh, are people wearing masks?
No.
Can you walk into a grocery store without a mask on?
Well, I went into a grocery store yesterday, and I'd say 95% of the people wear masks, which was encouraging. Mm-hmm. And so to me, people are taking it seriously to a large extent, but I have been in settings where there are virtually no masks. So I'm not sure. There's no question that wearing a mask reduces transmission. That's beyond doubt. Any expert can tell you that. But the mask wearing that I observe in Pittsburgh and even in Toronto when I'm back visiting my children, it's pretty lax.
So, and let's face it, in the fans, in the arena bowls, not every fan is wearing a mask of the arenas.
No, but on some arenas, people are pretty diligent. Again, I think it varies depending. That's all I do now when I watch is check out the attendance and check out the mask wearing. And some buildings are far better than others, and we've got to do a better job. There's no question in my mind about that.
Well, do you think mask wearing in the arena should be mandated?
Well, again, you go to the experts here. The rate of vaccinations, the amount of transmission that's permitted or that's acceptable, I take that guidance from whatever the experts tell us it is. So in some buildings, you don't see a lot of mask wearing. Others, you do. And we are getting our arms around this virus as a nation, as the two countries put together, as a hockey playing mass of athletes, we are getting our arms around it. Just, maybe we have to tighten up a little bit more.
I just find it very curious. Like I'll walk into a grocery store. You cannot walk into a grocery store or any store without wearing a mask. You can't here. It's not an option. And then I'll watch a game at Scotiabank, and I see almost nobody wearing a mask sitting, shoulder to shoulder with a mm-hmm. bunch of people they don't know. I find that so curious that people take that position.
Yeah, it varies by team. And again, I watch hockey every night, and it's the first thing I look at. How many masks, how many people are in the building, how many are wearing masks, and it varies. Some teams have good compliance. It's mandated still in some arenas, and some don't. We've got to do a better job.
Hey, just curious, you have traveled back and forth between the countries. Do you notice the difference on how the two countries have managed protocols during this time?
Well, I'm shocked. Last time I was in Toronto walking around with the mask on. So when I park, say I have to go to the bank and then get gas, I wear a mask. When I get out of my car, I walk to the bank, I wear a mask till I'm done, whatever I'm doing in the bank, and then I wear my mask back to my car. Mm-hmm. If I stop for gas, I wear a mask. So I'm pretty diligent about it. I think most people are, but I do, walking up Bayview Avenue, I do see a lot of people who are not wearing masks.
Yeah, it's curious, but it is what it is. We want to we almost mandated to spend some time talking about what has happened and is happening in Chicago. I assume you had an opportunity to watch Gary and Bill's news conference the other day.
I saw excerpts of it. Yes.
There's been quite a bit of criticism about the way it was handled. And I'm wondering if you wanted to share your thoughts on how the NHL has dealt with this obviously unfortunate situation.
Yeah, unfortunate would be a mild word for it. Catastrophic, I think, would be a better word. But I think the league, if you look at, okay, here's the fact situation that was presented to the league. Were the penalties appropriate and swift? Yes. Have systems been put in place? The most important thing to me is, how do we make sure this doesn't happen again? And I sense the league is working very hard to make sure those systems are in place. So I think there's been some very swift, harsh, and appropriate penalties. And I think there's safety nets put in place to make sure athletes that are in harm's way can find help and get help and stop this stuff. So I think that I think overall, in response to a cataclysmic event, the league's response has been swift and harsh. And hopefully, again, the key to me is, how do we deal with the two victims? How do we help them? And then how do we make sure this can't happen again?
You have worked for Gary. You know Gary. There has been a lot of personal criticism of Gary's handling of this in the last 72 hours. Do you feel that Gary's position within the league has been shaken because of this?
No, I don't think so. I'll tell you why. I think that, you know, as a league, we move from crisis to crisis, depending on the scale. So it could be a player gets arrested for a DUI, a player gets arrested for assault and battery. And the league has to deal with those things as they occur. And I think the league's track record of dealing with those things has been excellent. And I think in this case, again, you may argue that the penalties weren't severe enough, or we didn't move quickly enough as a league. And those are valid criticisms, perhaps. But I think overall, the key here is, did the league take this crisis head on and deal with it swiftly and harshly? And most importantly, have they looked after the people that got overlooked in the first place here? And to me, I think the league's response, no matter what answer I give, John, people are going to say, I can't believe Brian Burke just defended the NHL. But I think overall, your job when you're dealt with, when you deal with a crisis, is to say, okay, what happened? How do we punish it? And how do we fix it?
So let's take a step back. Have you read the report from the law, from the legal firm in Chicago?
I watched it read, yes.
If you had been the general manager of the Chicago Blackhawks at the time, and I know it's a hypothetical, you would have managed it differently?
Yeah, I don't know. The fact pattern that's presented, unless you know all the facts, and this is why, as a member of the Pittsburgh Penguins, I'm going to say, I don't know everything that happened. I read the report. I followed as close as I could. And again, the question's going to be, at the end of the day, were the penalties that were handed down, were they harsh? Were they swift enough? Has this dealt with the issue? Has it dealt with the problem? Has it put systems in place? And on that basis, I'm comfortable that we've done, if not everything we could do, we've done most of it, and we'll get to the rest of it. Knowing the league, they'll get to the rest of it. So I heard criticism that they didn't do this or that. Knowing the league, they'll get to it and they'll deal with it. So I have comfort that the league will deal with these problems as they occur. And that's the number one thing is, okay, something's going to happen in the next week involving an athlete. Mm-hmm. Has the league got systems in place to deal with it swiftly and appropriately? That's the key for me, and I think they do.
I don't have any issue with the time frame, you know, as you referred to it, the swiftness with which the NHL has acted in the past and has acted here. I think that was well within the realm of reasonableness. The one that I'm having the hardest time with is a $2 million fine to the Chicago Blackhawks organization, an organization that's worth, you know, has a value of over $1 billion. And ultimately, was the organization responsible for what happened? Yes, it was the individuals involved, from the president to the general manager to the head coach, and even arguably the assistant general manager, although Sheveldayoff got no punishment for it. But a $2 million fine for an organization that is worth over $1 billion seems to me, Brian, to be even less than a slap on the wrist. Give me your thoughts on that.
Well, I can tell you it's the largest fine ever handed down in the NHL. And I believe maybe league wide, it's right up there with them. It's a very significant fine. It's not an insignificant amount of money. And you can say the net worth of the franchise is this or that, but the fact of the matter is it's a very substantial fine.
Well, but there was a fine, a $3 million fine levied for, I can't remember the whole incident.
The Kovalchuk contract was,
yeah,
I believe, a $3 million fine.
Yeah, and loss of draft choices, etc. You know,
no, they didn't in the end pay it. They didn't end up paying it, and it got rescinded. But yes,
it just seems to me to be an inconvenience, an irrelevance. Two guys were forced to fall on their swords, and probably will never work in the National Hockey League again. And I'm not defending them by any stretch of the imagination. But what I'm saying is that it seems that the commissioner, who works for the owners, was light on the owner of the Chicago Blackhawks. Now, there may be, you know, there's a civil case ongoing. Excuse me. The Blackhawks will have to pay in that. But that shouldn't, I mean, the league has to come down harder on the team, because ultimately they are responsible for everybody that works for them and everything that goes on in that arena. And the argument, Brian, that we are hearing is Gary did not unleash hell on Wirtz, which he should have, their argument is, because he works for them. You've been in that office and you've run franchises. Is that a misappropriation of responsibility?
Well, I think what I would say, Bob, is you've got to look at this question, I think, in two ways. One is, in your opinion, is it sufficient? And there are going to people say it's never sufficient. It's not sufficient. When I say three key top-ranking executives lost their jobs over it, and a $2 million fine, which you may argue wasn't sufficient, that's a massive fine. I think again, people argue it wasn't enough, but it certainly was significant. The penalties were harsh and severe.
And this may be a difficult question to answer, Brian, but in your time and your knowledge, and you've been enough board meetings, do you ever think Gary gets a sense that he actually works for the owners? My own personal thing is, there are days there's a perception it's the other way around.
I don't think this is a case where I can tell you from the league, I've never heard them once say, well, this is an owner that, you know, has been a good owner, we have to look after him, or this and that. They've done what they think is the right thing every single time, in my experience, even where it's worked to my detriment. So right. The Bertuzzi-Moore case, the fines and the punishments were swift. They were severe. It impacted on my franchise. It impacted on my players. And the league did what they thought was the right thing. I don't think it's a bunch of owners that pay my salary. It's, we're going to do the right thing at this time, because that's the lens that we're viewed under and the lens we're judged by.
There are two factors in this, in my opinion. One is the reaction to the situation, and the other is, as you discussed earlier, the measures that the league, the teams, the game can take to try and mitigate how often this happens. I mean, the notion that you're going to be able to eliminate it entirely is probably unrealistic. But how do you do that, Brian? What specific things can you put in place to keep these predators out of your sport? and out of sport in general, because as you know, we've seen this, we saw this with the women's U.S. women's gymnastics team, you know,
soccer,
horrific
women's soccer.
Oh, over and over and over again. And I want to make sure we point that out, because it's not just about hockey, although it's happened in hockey on numerous occasions too. What the heck can you do? What systems can you put in place to eliminate these people from becoming involved even?
Well, I think certainly the league's approach is that they want to make sure this never happens again. Now, is that realistic?
No.
It's happened in other sports? Can you insulate a league against every bad act or every bad actor? The answer is probably not. But there's got to be a system where they identify this conduct, deal with it swiftly, give the people the support they need when it does happen. And in the meantime, let's head off as much as we can. And I think that's the direction the league has said, is let's make this better. Let's provide the right services for people who fail, the system fails them. And that's the key for me, is my whole focus on this whole last 10 days has been, how do we make sure it doesn't happen again? And how do we help the people who are most affected by this?
And so when you say, how do we do that? What are we talking about? I mean, we hear about hotlines. We hear about people being able to discuss things anonymously. The bottom line is people need to feel confident if something happens that they are going to be looked after. How do you do that?
Well, I think it's reporting, for one, so that people report when something happens, they report it right away. Anonymous tip lines are probably a great way to do that. When I say probably, not saying that probably work. I mean, I think that's one of the safety nets you have to put in place. Reporting systems that identify this behavior, the ability for an athlete to complain about it and get heard right away. So I think there's a lot of things. I don't think the league has looked at this and said, you know, it's too bad, let's move on. I think the league's looked at this, so it's too bad, let's make sure it doesn't happen again. Yeah. Some horrible things have happened. Some horrible allegations have been made. Some horrible allegations have been established and proved. So let's make sure it doesn't happen again. Can we insulate against every bad act or every bad actor? No. But can we put systems in place that stop most of this behavior, or virtually all of it? And can we fix it for players when the system is breached? Do we have remedies for them to come forward and get the help they need and stop the behavior?
What's the responsibility of the other players in this, Brian?
Well, I'm not going to get into that. That to me is I don't know. The answer to your question is, I don't know. I don't know what was heard and said, and I don't know what play. I've heard all these allegations and things. I don't know.
No. I'm not talking about the beach situation. I'm just talking about this. This to me speaks to the culture of the game as much as possible. And I maybe use the word loosely, but the sanctity of the dressing room. And you know, you and I have talked many times about, you know, being on a team and being loyal to each other. But does this change any of that as we look forward?
I never felt when I was a player that there was a sanctity of the room, that a player who was being abused was sheltered in any way. I've never felt that. That sanctity, that extends to certain practices in our game, not to sexual misconduct, never to sexual misconduct. And to the fact that if anyone felt that was part of the sanctity of the room, that thinking has to stop immediately. If it hasn't already, that's got to stop. You see something wrong, you report it right away. That's got to be the rule going forward. No question about that.
And yet, in the beach situation, he took the rather unusual step, I think we would agree, of reporting. And management, because of the timing of this at the, you know, during a Stanley Cup run, which was ultimately successful for the organization, they literally put it on the back shelf and didn't deal with it for at least 3 weeks, and really didn't deal with it at all for all the reasons we know. They put his name on the Stanley Cup. They really didn't do much of an investigation, it would appear. Quenneville gave him recommendations for future employment. I mean, so many things that went wrong in this that were the responsibility of the individuals and the organization, the Chicago Blackhawks. You know, the primary historic scenario is the individual who's been abused is so traumatized or embarrassed by what has happened to them that they withdraw and do not tell anybody. And many times it takes years for them to muster up the courage to do that. That was not the case here. This young man reported this quickly, and the organization failed to act.
And to the players' union as well, Bob.
Well, and that raises that question too. Berkey, you opened your mouth. You wanted to say something. I want to let you talk.
No, I just there's no question that there was failure here. You can't argue that.
Yeah,
right. You can't argue that the delay didn't make sense. You can't argue that it wasn't dealt with swiftly and fairly. And I have no defense for any of the people involved in that. Just to me, the key here is, okay, have we dealt with the consequences of this failure harshly and swiftly? Have we punished the people involved, and have we put systems in place and forward so this can't happen again? I say can't. We know that it can, but can we minimize the chances of this happening? Get it to zero, hopefully. But if we can't, can we minimize the ability of these things to be not dealt with swiftly and harshly and the right systems put in place? And that, to me, is the key going forward as a team executive. I want to know that my team has players in that position who would be safe if they came forward, who would feel good that there would be swift reaction. That's what I'm concerned about.
Brian Burke is our guest. We'll take a quick break and come back with more after these messages. Bob McCowan, John Shannon, Brian Burke, the president of Hockey Ops for the Pittsburgh Penguins, with us. Berkey, before the break, John mentioned the Players Association, and I know you may have some reluctance to dip your toe in that, but there is some level of responsibility there. And one of the things that John and I talked about yesterday, this is one of the great conundrums of a players association. You know, two players get involved in something, and the one of the two players is likely to be subject to greater punishment than the other. And the players association defends the accused even more vigorously than they defend the victim. And I don't pretend to know the answer to that, but it is a reality. And every time it comes up, you kind of scratch your head and go, well, how does this work? Do you have
Brian's
a sense?
Brian's been on both sides of that. Brian, well, as an agent's been on that one side, and as the sheriff, he's been on the other side.
Well, I mean, I'll let you address that. I mean, it's a little bit off topic, but if you want to address that, I mean, you see the inconsistency in that, don't you?
No, I don't. That's you have to have a governing body that's in charge. So you're in a baseball game and someone throws a pitch at someone and there's a brawl. So someone has to rule on it. So who rules on it? It's always a governing body. They have to retain control over that. There isn't a limited appeal right, but basically, when I did supplementary discipline for the players, and mind you, this is a much bigger case. This is a much more, you're talking much bigger problems, systemic problems. And the reason I'm going to duck an answer on the Players Association is I don't know what was said to the Players Association and what they did with it. That has not come out anything that I've seen. So we'll see, and I'll have more to say if and when I find out what happened. Right now, I just heard allegations that the players were told and nothing happened. That's all I know. On the Players Association side, the Players Association, when I had a supplementary discipline hearing case, the union never weighed in and said, you've got to give less punishment to this case because they represent the victim and the perpetrator, if you will. So a guy high sticks a guy, he gets a four game suspension for it. The union never came into those hearings and said, well, you can't give him anything on this. You can't do that. They understand that there's some punishment to be borne. What they would point out is this player is never, he's not a repeat offender. He's never been in front of this court before. He's generally a clean player, and that should mitigate whatever punishment he receives. No one ever came in and said, you can't touch this guy because he's a member of our union and he's one of the guys. It's always been, league's going to do what they think is right. And that is, I really believe at the end of the day, that's where Gary Bettman comes out on this. I know from working at the league, Gary told me 100 times, do the right thing. Don't do the popular thing. Don't do the difficult, the easy thing. Do the right thing.
Well, okay. But if we translate this, you know, into a court of law, it is inconceivable that one lawyer would defend both the accused and the victim.
No, it's not actually. In this case, that's the way it's set up in pro sports. So well, when you have a transgression on the ice, the league has final say over what happens, subject to a limited right of appeal. It's always been that way. It's the same way in baseball, same way in football. The NFL rules on if a guy spears a guy, the NFL rules on it.
But the Players Association is going to try and mitigate the punishment to the accused.
I've never seen that.
Well, you're telling me the Players Association has never gone in and said an 8-game suspension is too much by comparison to this, and this. Isn't that exactly what happens?
No, that happens on appeal. But in the hearings, no one ever came in and said, you've got to give less than this. They came in and present, the player has a clean record, is not a prior offender, no repeat offender, and you have to rule on this. So, no, never once did the union call me and say, you got to let this guy off. He's a star. You got to give him less. They just took their medicine, and that's the way it should be.
And if you're the victim of this situation, and we have seen this in courts of law before, there is an expectation, even a demand, for significant punishment. Who defends that person in that situation? Does the Players Association? They can't defend them too.
Yeah, so if you're talking about systemic things, if you're talking about a case like Kyle Beach, if you're talking about sign stealing with the Houston Astros, if you're talking about systemic issues, not a 4-game suspension where the union is not. So, yes, at some point, I assume the union comes in a different with a different hat on, and that's their job, I guess. But in this case, like with Kyle Beach, I don't know the specifics and I don't duck questions very often. You know that, but I don't know what happened there and I'm not going to wager a guess on it.
Yeah. Hey, curious, when you took the job in Pittsburgh, it was the Metropolitan Division or whatever it was, the playing each other 8 or 9 times. You're back to the regular schedule. How much more of a challenge is this versus the system you had during the 56 game schedule?
Well, it was completely different. I mean, it was, you know, 2 games at a time. You fly to New York, you play the Rangers twice, you get on a plane with self-prepared, self-contained food, you eat in a meal room, get on the plane, there's no service on the plane, you fly then to the next city. So say it was Washington. You play 2 games, you go back. No interaction with players, no food service on the flights, no interaction with the players. We were completely bubbled down. So it's very different. Now it's more, you're traveling more. You're not playing 2 games at a time. It's much different. It's much better, obviously, than playing teams 6, 8, 10 times. But it's a new challenge in terms of COVID. And it's a new challenge in terms of the quality of opponents and the frequency you play them.
Do you think that the lack of playing time against basically 3/4 of the league probably hurt your team or helps your team at any point, or does it matter?
No, I'm a big believer that all things are equal once the game starts. So the fact that we hadn't played that team last year and now we're playing them, so we didn't play Tampa last year. This year we played them in the first game. And we played him again in the 6th game, I believe. That's once the puck drops, that's on us. That's on our players to find a way to win that game. The fact is, well, we didn't see them last year. Well, they didn't see us last year. So those are, to me, those factors are all equal. They're all a wash.
And is there anything out of the 56-game schedule that you liked, you'd recommend that you'd like to see put into an 82-game schedule?
Well, the only thing, and we didn't see it this year, is what we saw last year was the 2-game sets. We call them sets.
Sure.
Where we went in and played an opponent twice. We felt that reduced travel cost and wear and tear. We like that fact. We like the playing sets where you play a team twice. That saves an airfare, that saves some travel, saves some wear and tear on your players. But I'm not sure it's easy to do with the schedule now back in, you know, normal opponents and normal travel.
Do you know, is it being discussed? I mean, was that commentary viewed with reception by the National Hockey League?
That view was expressed, but again, you know, you try and do a schedule where you're.
Oh, playing. I understand. I get it. You know, I get it.
And the teams would say, well, that really helps you is if you're going in a fair distance. So if you're flying in from Vegas to Vancouver, could you not play them twice? I'm not sure the same economy applies. We're playing the Rangers and Devils back to back, and we have a bus ride. So I'm not sure it's feasible.
Let me ask you this. One of the things that schedule makers have done historically in all sports is try and balance the number of home games and away games between teams. But you cited an East Coast team going west to a Vegas or Vancouver or LA, wherever, where you would traditionally play them once at home and once away.
Yeah.
What about the notion of going into a Vegas and playing them twice away in 1 year, and then they come and play twice in Pittsburgh the following year? Is there an inconsistency in that? Even if at the end of the day, Brian, the schedule, you wind up with 41 home games and 41 road games.
Yeah, our teams are kind of particular about seeing Sid. I don't know if you noticed that, but they're kind of particular on seeing them every year.
Wow.
The league put in the rule years ago. In fact, I was at the NHL when they changed it, that they're going to play every team in every building once every year. And I think there are fans that really like that. So I'm not sure what the answer is. I know one thing. Every single schedule you do, we get our schedule. We bitched about it as soon as we got it.
Of course.
And when we get the schedule next year, we're going to bitch about it as soon as we get it. You can't do a schedule that makes everyone happy. You can't do a schedule that's perfect. And overall, I think the league does the best they can and produces a great product with some meaningful matchups down the stretch. So overall, I think they get a great grade on it. It's impossible to do it perfectly. It's impossible to even do it really well, but I think they do a good job.
You like physical hockey. Do you like the way the cross-check crackdown has occurred?
Well, yes. The short answer is yes. To me, I think, like most rule changes, there was a much bigger kerfuffle about the cross-checking, and the epidemic was a much bigger kerfuffle than it required. But as is the case, sometimes when you focus on a problem that's much bigger than it needs to be, in my view, I don't think cross-checking was at an epidemic. But the focus on it, saying let's take out some of the more egregious ones, I mean, there's a couple different things. One is the placement of the cross-check. So if you cross-check a guy in the back of the neck, or you cross-check him right above the pants, right below where his shoulder pads are, you got a real risk of hurting the guy or really making him sting. You cross-check him across the shoulder blades, it's probably not going to hurt him even a little bit because he's got heavy padding there. And then the placement away from the puck. If a guy's 10 feet from the puck and you cross-check him just to disrupt his possession of the puck and he falls down, they're calling that. I don't mind that because that's not really a hockey play. That's interference as much as a cross-check. So I think the emphasis has taken out a couple of the worst ones or the more egregious ones. And so overall, yeah, I give it a passing grade. I think it was a much bigger fuss than we needed to get to where we are, but I like where we are.
A couple of things real quickly before we let you go. Sid is back. Malkin is not. What is he, about 2-3 weeks away, do you think?
At least, yeah.
Yeah. But you have contracts of significance that you have to deal with, decisions to make. Or are there decisions with guys like Malkin and Letang's in his last year too, right?
Yep.
As a generic sense, do you make those decisions in advance or do you wait as long as possible to make the decisions as to how you want to proceed?
Well, we went through the interview process with ownership and talked about these scenarios. And so we have a plan in mind on what makes sense. We certainly admire the two players involved. They're in their last year. And so we'll deal with it as we go along. But right now, the key here has been to get Chris Letang back playing because he was out with COVID. And we got to get Evgeny Malkin playing again before we have any decisions to make.
Hey, I remember your press conference when you got there and you were joking that you finally got to be with Sid after missing him by that much in the draft lottery in Ottawa when you were in Anaheim. What do you know about Crosby now that you didn't know when you took the job?
Just admiration. I knew what a hard worker he was. I knew what a leader he was, but he's all of that and then some. So I'm astounded at his work ethic and his attention to detail. It's impossible on our team to not work hard because your captain's out there working harder than everybody else all night. It's pretty special.
Final one for me. When you were at the league, I believe you hired a young guy that really in many ways doesn't get the credit for changing a lot of the game. And that's a guy named Dan Craig, who they announced retired this week. Dan Craig is the ice guru. And he's made a difference for all of us in the game. What did you see in Dan Craig and what do you view he's done for the NHL?
Well, he's had a huge impact. He's been a tremendous influence on how we make ice in the league. But this all started when I worked at the league and Gary called me in and said, how come we have bad ice? How come we can't get better ice? And I said, well, you know, Madison Square Garden, they got basketball in the afternoon and hockey at night and ice capades, and the circus used to come for, I think the circus was there for 4 weeks.
Wow.
In February, 3 shows a day. And I said, we'll never have good ice. And Gary said, well, that's not a good enough answer. And Gary said, you track down whoever the best ice guy is and find out why we have good ice. So I said, Gary, it's Edmonton. And all they have to do is open the doors. Just open the doors in the afternoon and it goes to minus 20 and you have great ice. So I flew to Edmonton and I joked with Dan Craig. I said, you got an hour. And 2.5 hours later, I was still there. Little things like a lot of teams back then in Anaheim, we changed the blade on the Zamboni. So when you resurface, there's a big blade that cuts and shaves the ice down and takes out some of the deepest ruts. They changed the blade in Edmonton every day. They use 7 blades a week. We did 1 a month. And wow. So when Dan came in, spotting the temperature, the chemical balance of the water, the Edmonton water has high limestone content. So we changed that. Monitoring the temperature, addressing the dew point, and when you drop the bowl down to 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Dan Craig changed all of that and made us all better at making good ice. And he'll be missed.
Indeed. Berkey, it's always our pleasure. We thank you very much for your time and look forward to having the opportunity to chat again soon. Meantime, best of luck to you and the Pittsburgh Penguins and good health, more importantly. Thanks, pal.
Thanks, guys.
Brian Burke, we'll come back and wrap it after these messages. Bob McCown, John Shannon, thanks to Brian Burke for being with us today on the program. The wounded Vegas Golden Knights came to town with the same record as the Toronto Maple Leafs, actually.
Yeah.
And got beat 4-0. And
got beat easily, Bob. Toronto played well.
Well, and I guess that's the point.
The big guns came to play. The big guns came to play.
Yeah, well, if you're a Maple Leaf fan, you're encouraged by what you saw last night. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you're a Golden Knights fan, maybe you say, well, we were missing how many guys? 5 guys?
5. Yeah. Five of your top forwards.
Yeah. So what do you expect?
Yeah.
Or is there a sense that this Vegas team may be heading in the wrong direction?
Well, I mean, you wonder because you start hearing stories about the Golden Knights being interested in Jack Eichel for next year because he's not going to be ready for this year, I don't think. But at the same time, they play in a division that if they can get through this and be NHL 500, win as many as they lose by the time their players get back and they're
they'll
hoping
be fine.
To get, they should be okay. They should be okay. Now that's the challenge. And this is one where you just have to be patient and hope that some of the talented young guys can come through for them and some of their veteran players who are still in the lineup can be a difference maker. So that's I think what George and Kelly and Pete DeBoer are looking at right now. Just stay in the race for now and then see what happens.
And I think if you're a Maple Leaf fan, you're finally going, oh, well, thank God, you know, we finally beat somebody with a little bit of emphasis, although they've won, what, 3 in a row now?
Yes, sir. Yeah.
But I don't think they were overly satisfied with the first two victories. I'm happy to have them, but not overly satisfied. I'm not sure this one should be viewed much differently because Vegas had nobody to score goals.
Yeah. The only thing I would say is it's who scored the goals for Toronto. Matthews with a pair, Nylander scored, Marner scored.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you what, Jack Campbell in goal. Jack Campbell. Boy, every time he comes out, he's become the safety net for this hockey club. When he plays, they have a better chance of winning, and you can see the players want to play in front of him.
Well, this is an interesting stretch for Toronto's favorite team. Because even though Vegas was a shadow of themselves, roster-wise, who they got, Tampa next.
Mm-hmm.
And then, who's the third one? Pretty tough one, too. I can't remember.
Is that Florida? No.
Might be.
Okay.
So this is a stretch of games where, in theory, you get to see exactly what this team is. And yet, when you're 10, 15 games into the regular season, I just don't know how much this means. And a perfect example of that is to go back to the beginning of our conversation today in baseball with the Atlanta Braves. How right. important were the Atlanta Braves?
By the way, it's Lightning, Bruins, Kings are the next three for the Maple Leafs.
All right, so you got the Bruins after the they're always a tough, even though they're not playing well right now. You know, that's the sword of Damocles hanging over the head of the
Toronto. They're having the same conversations in Boston about the Bruins that we are having about the Maple Leafs in Toronto.
Well, sure. And at the end of the day, these are games that you think could be barometers for where you're at. Yeah. And yet it's awful early to make that suggestion. The one thing we know is we're out of time. And so we'll bid you a fond adieu, again, with thanks to Brian Burke. You look like you want to say something.
No, I'm just listening to you intently. Yes, I'm a fidgety guy today.
You're a fidgety guy every day. On behalf of John Shannon, Bob McCowan, have yourselves a swell one, and we'll see you tomorrow if the crick don't rise. Goodbye, everybody.